There are people talking about football in a fancy new room, accompanied by a fancy new theme by Johnny Rep, at the studios of Sunshine 106.8 FM. It must be the Day Trippers. Tonight's show is the first from our new home, our new recording night. Change is good, however, and we've a belter of pod in the offing for you tonight. Our all-time 11 feature, a look at the UEFA FFP regulations, including a chat with our guest Ed Thompson, a preview of the Newcastle game, and of course, our listeners' questions form the agenda for tonight. So let's get straight into it with a look at the next position in our all-time 11 team. Now, having discussed goalkeepers last week, this evening we're looking at right back, so I'm going to get the ball rolling here with my shout. My shout is probably going to upset a few people. It's Marcus Babbel. It has to be someone that you saw. It has to be someone that you admired. It has to be someone that played while you were a fan. Now, I could have gone back, because I'm an old bastard, as far as Phil Neal. I didn't. I could have gone several places. I'm going with Marcus Babbel. In my opinion, he was the classiest right fullback that I've seen put on the red shirt. So,
great eyebrows.
Great eyebrows.
He's not just
great
a classy eyebrows. Right back, he was a classy defender.
Yeah, he's a classy man.
Yeah,
he's a
classy man.
So that's my shout. So we'll get the ball rolling then. Phil, you're up.
I'm going to stick with Steve Finnan. Good man. Just because we're the we are the Steve Finnan of podcasts.
That is what you call on message, Tyler. That is being on message.
But genuinely, I'm keeping somebody else back because I'm playing him in a different position, so otherwise I would have picked him. But definitely, for me, it was a toss-up between Rob Jones and Steve Finnan in terms of who I've watched. I could have gone with
Rob Jones. Goal scorers.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
At least Finnan got one.
But like, in terms of, for me, Finnan was a solid, as Rafa said himself, he was a solid seven player. He never let the team down. He always turned in a performance. He was possibly the most solid right back that I can remember seeing in a Liverpool side, even with Rob Jones there. Rob Jones had so many problems with injury that an awful lot of his career was robbed by it. So, yeah, I've no arguments going with Finnan. I'm staying on message.
Steve, yeah, that's wonderful, very professional. Steve Brown, your choice.
My shout's also Marcus Babbel. I remember being at the UEFA Cup final in 2001 in Dortmund Stadium, and Babbel was just excellent. Gerrard playing ahead of him, and the two of them just ran amok for the opening half an hour until Alaves got back into the game. But Babbel was just the epitome of German precision. That's the only way to describe the man. He was just never put a foot wrong. It's just a pity, obviously, with the illness that he did end up contracting, that we didn't have him for longer. Yeah. But yeah, definitely Marcus Babbel.
The only
problem was the keep.
Yeah. Andy, your shout.
I'm gonna go a little bit different here. Unfortunately, there was a couple of players further up the pitch that I wanted to get into the team.
Oh, here we go, you're messing with the whole thing. It's unbelievable.
And there's three centre-backs that I want in the team.
Oh, come on.
My formation is going to be three at the back. So I'm going to go for a right-sided centre-back, and it's Alan Hansen. I couldn't leave a player like that out of a team at best 11, to be honest with you. Modern day centre backs always want to play football, but back then he was one of very few players in England that could play football out the back. I can think we could do it more that these days with Liverpool, especially with the formation that Rodgers is playing now. So Alan Hansen for me, Mr. Cool, he's one of them players that he seemed to see the game in slow motion. You know, he was that good at reading everything, but he had it all. Always stayed on his feet, tackled on his feet. So an all round quality player. So he's my show for the fourth man in defence.
Thank you very much.
Inside the box from Andy.
You may have noticed that Andy is not. He's a maverick. He's a maverick. This Steve Daly,
a wild gunslinger.
You're up next, Steve.
My shout. I would definitely be one to agree with the two lads on Marcus Babbel, in the sense of having not got the best out of him. Unfortunately, I think, you know, when we signed him at that time, probably so excited about him coming on board. Similar to the likes of when we brought Karl-Heinz Riedle in as well, you know, a player that you really thought was going to do so much for us. Thankfully, Babbel actually delivered. And apart from his illness, I think he would have went on to have many more years. So, yeah, no, I'm going to put him in at right back. It was a toss-up between him and Nicol. I think I was too young probably in terms of having seen him properly and to really appreciate him at the time. So it's looking back on stuff, and we've all agreed that too we have young. To have actually
tough paper on
too young.
Get your driver's license out, lads. I'm going to win this anyway.
I was thinking about going with Vegard Hegem at one stage.
Bjorn Thor Kavarme came in for me as well. Jesus. But,
okay, wonderful chaps. Thanks very much. I think we can put that one to bed. So we'll move on to our next feature.
Okay, next up is our look at Liverpool's financial situation vis-a-vis fair play regulations. We took as our inspiration for this feature an article from Beyond the Cop site by Nazar Degama and Ed Thompson, which attempted a projected analysis of Liverpool with regard to the financial impact of commercial revenue, also player transfers in and out of LFC. The article then tried to provide an early projected income statement for the financial year of 2013-2014. So we're lucky tonight to be able to speak directly with Ed. Ed, thanks for joining us tonight.
Hey, that's okay. Thanks for asking me.
First off, Ed, your site, financialfairplay.co.uk, is dedicated to new financial regulations in that are in place. And Liverpool FC have put themselves alongside Arsenal in the vanguard of pro-FFP lobby since the arrival of FSG. Are Liverpool becoming poster boys for FFP, or are they hindering themselves, in your opinion, by hitching their wagon so publicly to this particular setup?
Oh, well, I don't think they're hindering themselves in any way. I mean, you know, let's face it, the rules have come in, so everybody's going to have to comply with the rules. And, you know, I just think that there's an element of self-interest amongst the Liverpool owners, to be honest, that, you know, nobody wants to be in a position where you're losing £30-40 million every year. And actually, the financial fair play rules will mean that now with this new TV deal, that the club should really be on a kind of
wage movement.
Actually start to kind of break even and you know, perhaps even make a profit as well. So I think there's some self-interest in it in there as well. And also, having said that, there is also a piece of self-interest in as much as these rules will help the club. You know, they will put the brakes, as we've seen, on, you know, clubs like Manchester City and Chelsea and Paris Saint-Germain and other clubs who have been spending very freely. They'll put the brakes on them, and that will kind of improve the competitive position of Liverpool.
Sure. So basically, the way you're looking at it, there's a certain element of self-interest there from FSG's point of view. From the club's point of view, Ed, do you see Liverpool benefiting ultimately from sticking rigidly to the rules and like being to the fore and pushing them, or do you see it as something that could ultimately be a negative for the club?
Oh, no, I can't see any way that would be a negative for the club, to be honest. It's hard to predict the future. I mean, that is the difficult part here. You know, if we knew what was going to happen to the club in the future, if the club could guarantee on Champions League income, where it would be getting £30 million a year, you know, if you knew what was going to happen with new sponsorship deals, if you knew what was going to happen with future TV deals, then perhaps, you know, it'd be a much clearer position. But unfortunately, you can't. So I think the financial fair play should play to Liverpool's advantage, in as much as you've got to balance your incomings and outgoings, and Liverpool have a very strong international fan base. They're able to write very large commercial deals. You know that their current kit deal is huge, so they see the benefit of that. And so, provided they can effectively get into the Champions League, which, you know, they may well do this season, then I think the future does look pretty bright for the club, to be honest.
Excellent. There was a statement in the article that really took me by surprise. I just want to run it past you before I let the other guys ask you a few questions. Excellent. And the statement was pretty stark. There was a reference to the mythical net spend figure, which is largely irrelevant. Now, for most people, they think they're on the cutting edge if they're quoting net spend. They seem to think that it's very much where it's at. Could you explain the rationale behind the statement that net spend is actually a mythical idea?
Yes, no, it's a bit complicated. So don't doze off, because it's a little bit to do. I need to talk about accounts here. But all the financial fair play rules basically require broadly clubs to break even. Okay, so what is breaking even? Well, you know, you would expect it to be, well, you know what you're spending and you know what incomes you've got. I mean, it should be a fairly easy process. However, when we look at football clubs, the big expenditure is on transfer fees. And so, actually, the way that the UEFA's rules and accountancy rules work are that the the money spent on a player has to be written off over a number of years. So if a, you know, take the famous signing of Torres, Fernando Torres, he cost about £50 million. He was signed by Chelsea on a five-year deal. Well, actually, in terms of the accounts, that didn't get recorded as a minus £50 million in year one. Because he was on a five-year deal, it actually records as a minus £10 million for each of the next five seasons. And so you can spend a lot of money on a player, but actually not have a huge impact on the bank accounts that year. And then the reason why it also gets a bit messy is you know, what happens when you come to sell a player? Well, actually, once you sell a player, actually, whether you've made a profit or a loss in the accounts is all dependent on what we call the book value, and it kind of gets a bit nitty gritty and potentially boring to some people. But sure. Actually, when you've got the player like Torres, who was bought for £50 million, in the books of the club, he gets written down at £10 million a year as a cost. And after two seasons, he's actually sitting in there as a book value of £30 million. And then once you sell the player, if they sold the player on, well, actually, if they sold him for more than £30 million, they'd recorded that as a profit in that year. And if they sold it for less than £30 million, it would be a loss. So you can see, actually, you can get to a position where you can sell a player for well less than you bought them for, but actually record it as a profit in that year.
Right.
It gets quite complicated. I mean, Carroll perhaps is an example closer to people's hearts, you know. People say, well, you know, we bought him for £35 million, I believe it was, and sold him for whatever it was, £17 million. But actually, by the time Liverpool sold the player, he had a book value of about £17 million anyway. So in terms of the, you know, the impact in the accounts for that year, nothing. You know, it's actually the club is better off without him because they aren't then having to write down another chunk of money for the next year. And then they obviously don't have to pay his wages. So you see, it gets all a bit messy. So you can't quite look at you know, the finances of the club and say, well, you know, we've had this much money coming in and we spent this on new players. You kind of need to understand the whole position of the club. And another example is what happened at Manchester City, whereby, you know, they actually spent quite heavily in the summer. But up until the last, I think, one or two player spends, they were actually recording a net break even on the whole deal, just because of the fact that they'd let some players go. They were no longer having to write down their contract fee. They were saving money on wages. So it all gets a bit messy. So this, you know, you can't just look at, you know, net spend. You need to look at the whole position, and that's where it gets really messy. And that's where, well, people like Naz, who wrote the article, are really good. You know, he's able to. You know,
sure. So basically, us armchair experts who've been quoting net spend are completely clueless. Can I ask if you wouldn't mind? Phil's got a question for you now, Ed.
Ed, hey, it's Phil here. Listen, I was a bit fascinated reading your own site on financial fair play and also the intimations in Naz's article around the idea that the debt for equity conversion, in that a owner where a loss is above the permitted loss for the year can actually convert that to equity in the club and not actually have, well, can attain the break-even status that's set down in financial fair play. I suppose at a simple term for me, I'm trying to figure out, could that mean that sugar daddy owners like Abramovich or Sheikh Mansour, etc., could theoretically, year on year, break the rules around financial fair play for making a profit or coming in within the acceptable loss remit and continue to just convert to equity to cover whatever spend they wanted to do?
No, it doesn't quite work like that. Although up to an element, up to a point, you are right. So, you know, the idea of, you know, the UEFA's financial fair play rules are that clubs break even. Broadly, you manage the incomings and outgoings. Okay, so that's a kind of straightforward concept. But the way that they've looked at the rules is say, well, actually, you know, to be fair, you need to break even over. We won't look at break even over one season in UEFA. We'll do it over two or three seasons because that's kind of makes sense. Something might have happened one season and not the other. Okay, so that's kind of how they approach it. And then they say, actually, although we say you've got to break even, well, it's not quite break even. We'll allow you to lose over those. The initial period was two seasons. Over the first two seasons, you can lose €5 million. We'll let you lose €5 million, and with that, there's no sanction if you lose up to 5 million, because it's not that much. However, we'll actually, having said that, we'll allow you to go up to €45 million loss over those two seasons. So as long as you've got a sugar daddy owner who can inject equity into the club to cover anything over the £5 million up 5 million euros up to the 45 million euros. Mm-hmm. So that's getting a bit complicated, but basically what it's saying, over the first 2 years, you can lose 45 million euros, which is about 37 million pounds.
Yeah.
But only, you can only go over this 5 million euros limit and go up to the 45 million maximum if the owner is prepared to inject equity. And what that means, inject equity, means that, in effect, the club creates new shares. Mm-hmm. Creates new shares, and the owner then buys the shares. And he has to buy the shares for the amount of the equity. In this example, it would be whatever's over 5 million euros up to, however makes it, up to 45 million. So, you know, he could be putting in, you know, 40 million euros or whatever it could be. And then that money then goes into the club. That money goes into the club and the club's debts don't increase. And that's the idea behind this, that UEFA don't want the club's debts to increase. And what's the owner got to show for it? Well, he's got some more shares, more bits of paper. Well, he would have had 100% of the shares in the club anyway, so having more shares actually doesn't help him in any way. The only way he'll ever get the money back on that is if the club sells the club for a profit, or if the club actually report a profit from you know, trading, and then actually he can pay himself a dividend out of the money. But he ties his money in. What the rule says you're not allowed to do is, whereas we saw in the past, clubs would just run up big debts and would owe the bank more money and, you know, living on overdrafts in effect. They're no longer able to do that. If they go over the 5 million euros, they can only go up to 45 million euros loss over those two seasons, and only then if the owner actually sticks his hand in the pockets and puts that money into the club.
Just to cut in there, right, and it's the bit that I'm trying to get my head around, is it only for those two seasons? What I'm wondering is, at the end of the two seasons, can he continue to put it? Is there that 45 million sort of spread that they have, or does it finish there and you've only got a 5 million loss which you can run regardless of whether you're going to convert further losses to equity as such?
Well, it's a rolling process. So, you know, after that, then it looks at the next three seasons. But then the threshold is then reduced that the owner can put in.
Right.
So after the first two seasons, when it's 45 million euros over the first two seasons, then it looks at three seasons and it's like 45 million over those three seasons, and then it cuts down to 30 million over three seasons, if that's right. Yes. So it's reducing all the time, and now, I mean, the point is where we are now in this season. Say for Liverpool, for example, is for this season, next season, and the season after, Liverpool. His average loss has to be below £8 million a season.
Okay.
That's all it can be. And that isn't very much when you consider that they've historically lost, you know, over, you know, 30 million plus, 40 million, you know, much significantly higher figures. But now the result, you know, the maximum loss, and that's including the money that the owner can put in equity, is only around £8 million a season for, you know, this season, next season, and the season after. So the things have changed, and the big losses that we have seen are going to be reduced, and the ability for the owner to stick their hand in the pocket and credit to equity kind of starts tapering out now, and they're not really able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cheers, Ed. That's interesting stuff. Steve, here's a question for you, if that's okay.
Hi, Ed. Just something based upon what you've said there. So I was just listening back, and it's great to hear somebody give a good in-depth analysis of the FFP situation. But will this eventually stop the likes of, let's take Real Madrid, for example, who in the past have, as you said there a moment ago, run up massive debts and been bailed out left, right and centre, whatever reasons may have been given for it.
Yeah.
Will that eventually stop this form of profiteering, so to speak, from a club like that?
It's difficult. The dynamics at, say, Real Madrid are a bit weird, in as much as they've got advantages. So Real Madrid particularly, they've got advantages because the TV deal in Spain is negotiated on an individual level rather than a group level. So they get all the TV money, basically, not all of it, but huge amounts gets cut up between Barcelona and Real. So they get that. They've also got big tax advantages as well. So they get huge advantages anyway. Being global brands, they're then able to write huge commercial deals. So the commercial deals that we see at the very, very top clubs are, you know, if anything, increasing. So things are potentially about to change in Spain. So, you know, we're seeing that they might no longer be able to write individual commercial deals. They might have to pull the deals, then the tax advantages might change. So it's a bit weird what's happening in Spain. But I guess what we are seeing, I guess going back to the thrust of the question is, you know, will we see clubs that were being bankrolled by sugar daddy owners, will we see that all changing? And the answer is very much yes. It has to, you know, as long as we assume that UEFA are serious about the rules, and we haven't yet seen it, seen what kind of punishments they're going to apply for overspending, then the landscape has to change. And you could argue it already has for many clubs. There's a few who've kind of like almost buried their head in the sand and saying, actually, we're just hoping it'll go away. But and that's the interesting point to see what happens there.
Ed, how you doing? It's Stephen Brown here. Just a quick one for you, Ed. My question is, obviously it's been driven by Platini and UEFA. What happens when Platini steps up to become the FIFA president, which looks like it will be the next step for him? Are UEFA going to keep pushing this as stringently as they will while Platini's with UEFA? And also, as a second part of that question, what would prevent, or is there any prevention measures being taken for clubs in different leagues, such as Qatar or any of the Middle Eastern clubs or Argentina or Brazil, that could go and spend the money that obviously Real Madrid and so on have spent every season?
Well, I guess in terms of UEFA, the big question is how serious are they about it? I mean, Platini and his deputy have both nailed their colours to the mast on FFP. I can't see Platini going that his, you know, his deputy, if you read all the interviews and they're so wedded to it that the change in Platini at the top, assuming this kind of deputy takes over, which is a likely scenario, then actually there's no change. And also that the important thing about the UEFA FFP rules is that they're actually voted in by the clubs. The European Club Association voted them in. So to have somebody then at the top actually then kind of going back on it and trying to change it would be very difficult. You know, there's a lot of very strong clubs within Europe, particularly the German clubs, who are very, very strong advocates of FFP. You know, European Club Association is headed up by Rummenigge. It's part of the DNA of UEFA now. I can't see that changing. You know, still the debate is how strongly it's going to punish clubs who breach the rules. But
Ed, just on that bit, is that because it benefits the bigger clubs in real terms, that FFP allows rich clubs to stay rich, and it's harder actually for the smaller clubs to become big clubs, because it's like you can't have that sugar daddy owner come in and spend 200 million, 300 million in one go to turn them into a super club?
Now, interestingly, I don't think it is, because if that had been the case, then the European Club Association, which is a huge number of clubs represent across Europe, the vast majority of whom do not have the sugar daddy only scenario, have voted for the rules to come in, and so the argument there appears to be, the reason why the clubs have voted it in is that by and large the vast majority of them are opposed to concepts where they are forced into a position where they have to overspend in order to succeed. And actually, genuinely, you know, you look at some of the pronouncements that's come out of Holland and Germany, you know, what happened in Chelsea and then Manchester City and Paris Saint-Germain, it's really deeply unpopular across a lot of clubs in Europe. And, you know, in each of, you know, you look at Holland, you know, it used to be in Belgium and Czech Republic. These used to be actually challenging at the top level in European football, and it's just not, it hasn't been possible for it recently. And one of the things that those clubs appeared not to like was the, you know, the concept of having to spend huge amounts of money in order to succeed, and not, you know, if you don't have a sugar daddy owner, or if you're restricted in being able to have one, which is the case in lots of clubs in terms of Germany, for example, then, you know, they're not able to succeed, and they would quite like, you know, the FFP rules to come in and stop that.
One very last question. I suppose one formed opinion that people have around FFP is that if you don't comply, you're out of European competition. That isn't the case. Am I right in thinking, like, and like, there's a good chance that if you don't comply with FFP, you're going to get a warning and then a slap on the knuckles before anything serious happens?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the way. People don't really know yet. What's happened is UEFA have issued punishments, and they've issued 9 sanctions, and they've said that any club that fails the break-even test will receive one of the sanctions. Those sanctions range from a warning up to a full exclusion from European competition. And kind of in the middle, they include things like potentially a points deduction when you're in the Champions League group stage or the Europa League group stage, or a reduction in the number of players that you can register for your European competition. So there's a kind of various levels of punishments that can apply. Although we know what the punishments are, what we don't have yet is a tariff of how those punishments will be applied. And UEFA has kind of been shying away from that, I think, because UEFA will argue that it's not actually them who's going to be issuing the punishment. They've set up an independent body which will determine whether or not clubs have breached the rules, and then they'll determine what rules will be applied. And they've done that so that UEFA can be at arm's length from any of the punishments that are imposed on the club, because ultimately the clubs can then appeal to CAS. Now, what's happened under the... I mean, we talk about FFP and we talk about break-even. We're familiar with that concept. But actually, under the whole FFP rules, it also includes requirements for clubs to stay up to date with their taxes and their transfer fees paid to other clubs. It's called payables. And this concept of overdue payables is part of the FFP rules. As UEFA, through this independent board, have already sanctioned a number of clubs and banned them from European competitions for falling behind on their tax bills, basically. And so they've already applied outright bans in European competitions. So we haven't yet seen what bans they're going to, or what punishments they're going to apply for overspend. But the punishments the board have so far applied have been very severe. So, we don't really know. And we won't know until April next year what punishments will be applied to clubs. And there'll be a number of clubs who will be looking at that very nervously. So the clubs are going to be Paris Saint-Germain, who have effectively failed the break-even test.
It's a tangled web, Ed, is basically what you're telling us.
Especially with Platini, however.
Listen, you're a gentleman. We've really enjoyed that. It's been very insightful. Thank you so much for the opinions and the answers.
And get on Ed's website.
Absolutely.
The financialfairplay.co.uk if you want more info around it.
Thanks a lot, Ed.
Brilliant. Many thanks. I enjoyed it.
Cheers. Thank you. Cheers. Appreciate it. Bye-bye. Bye.
Bye.
It's our preview of the game against Newcastle. Liverpool go into this joint top. Can they stay there? Well, if they're to do so, which team do you think is best suited to the task? So the first question I'm going to ask people is, what do you think the team will look like? Basically, the same as usual, what changes do you think are likely versus what changes would you like? So if you can do that in a nutshell for me, Steve, we'll start with you.
Yeah, for me, I touched on this last week. I think what will happen is Lucas will come back in. I think Hendo will be pushed out to the right and we'll pretty much line up the way we did against Crystal Palace. As I said, I would prefer to see Henderson in the middle. There's been a couple of shouts during the week I've seen, and I'm liking the idea of, even if Lucas was to come back in, to have Lucas and Hendo in there with Gerrard maybe playing the 10. And I think Sterling's done enough in his last game to keep his place. Whether he will or not, I don't know. But for me, maybe I'd go with Henderson, Lucas, and Gerrard in front, with Moses dropping to the bench and leaving Sterling on the right hand side.
And you see the formation staying the same?
I do, especially against Newcastle. I think he wants to keep the two lads up top. I think we normally have some joy in St. James's Park, and I think we'll stick with the three at the back. They've been so solid when Sacco's been in there as well. So I think he'll want to keep the three lads in there and really go for this from the off.
Fantastic.
Another early goal and a win.
That would be nice. Thanks, Steve. Andy, your ideas?
Yeah, I think at the moment the team pretty much picks itself. Rodgers, as we know, doesn't really like to change a winning team. So I'll disagree with Steve there. I don't think Lucas will come back in. I think he'll stick with Henderson. I think he deserves to sit there. I don't want to see Lucas coming in at Henderson's expense. If he is to come in, I just hope it's not Henderson pushed back out right. I did read that Johnson's back training. Mm. I don't know whether he's going to be ready. But I think if Johnson was fit...
I think Johnson's going to be the West Brom guy.
Yeah.
That's what they're saying. He is by training, but he won't be match fit for Saturday.
But if he was, obviously, I think it changed the perspective of that formation altogether. I think it will really start working for us, and it will really start looking like they're playing well with that system when Johnson comes back. So Sterling maybe stay right back. Henderson to stay in with Gerrard. Leave Lucas on the bench, and Moses again. So that's what I think will happen, and that's what I pretty much want to happen.
Okay. Bye on. Thanks, Andy. Phil, your ideas?
Well, for me, I think we're going to stay in the same shape.
do it the three at the back. Whether we go 4-1-2 or move it around again will depend on the lineup. For me, it's I want to see Gerrard at 10. Like yeah. after the England game and his captain fantastic routine coming up with the second goal. Mm.
It was a great goal as well, actually.
And it was strange seeing him again up the front end of the
pitch. How far forward was he?
Like, yeah. Do you know, and at that time as well, we haven't seen that in the Liverpool game this season. No. He's looked exhausted. Now, strange enough, I do think he'll probably look tired and exhausted come the second half of this game because he's played 180 minutes of the England game. So if I was going for the team, I'd go same back three. I'd like to see Henderson and Lucas in the centre midfield because I think Lucas is going to come back in as well. If Sissoko is even half fit, I'd put him in over Enrique, right? Because I just think we need something different. Not that Enrique isn't completely nuts, but it would be nice to go to St. James's Park and have a bit of attack and trust, which is more reliable down the left-hand side, and just to see what Sissoko looks like.
I like the way that Enrique being completely nuts is something, it's a positive for you.
Yeah.
It's a prerequisite in players. Are you batshit crazy? Why not?
I love him. He's mad.
Yeah, he's
a top man.
He's a mentalist. Right, yeah.
But at the same time, I'd like to see Sissoko start.
And the front line looks.
Well, it's Sturridge Suarez. I know Suarez has to come back from Mars or something to get to the game. But yeah. You don't change it. Yeah, like for me, if you have Gerrard, Suarez, and Sturridge, you're giving yourself your best chance to either dominate possession and create chances, or play really quick on the counter attack
and finish goals.
Yeah, right. Okay. And Sterling, yeah, I defended him after in our last review. I said that he did really well for his age and being out of position. Unless Johnson is fit, I'd play Sterling again. I'm fascinated to see what happens with Martin Kelly. I don't think Rodgers rates him, to be honest with you.
Right.
If he did, I think he would have been in the team at this point in time. Mm. And that's what I think. What I like, I'd probably change the whole shape and whole lot. I'd go 4-2-3-1. I'd have Lucas and Hendo in the centre midfield. The three I'd have would be Moses, Gerrard, and Suarez in that three. Mm-hmm. And then Sturridge up top on his own. And I'd actually put Martin Kelly then back in at right full.
Not
going against Sterling. This is what I'd like to see. And then I'd be happy enough playing Sissoko at left full because I think he'd give us great attacking verve down the left hand side. And Kelly, his size, his bulk, is ideal that if you want to then switch to a back three in game, you can actually change shape in game. Whereas if we go with the three at the back and move to four, we're moving Cola Torre to right back.
When everyone's fit and we have Sissoko on one side and we have Johnson on the other side, Brendan's new system's going to look a hell of a lot more effective.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Definitely, and we have a selection headache then when everyone's fit. Yeah. But at this moment in time, we don't have everyone fit. By the way, the one thing I want to see is at 60 minutes, I want to see Alan come on the pitch. Mm. If he's fit to be in the squad, I want to see Alan on the pitch. I want to see Alan and Hendo beside each other on the pitch.
Okay.
And leave Gerrard up top.
I'm going to cut across you there because you've just exasperated the bejesus out of poor Steve.
Every single show we had is gone now.
You're going to say something about Alan. Now, yeah. Apparently he's fit again.
Apparently he's in training. Apparently he's back for Saturday in some capacity anyway. I think that we can probably win this game in an hour.
Yeah,
I think Gerrard, as the lad said, Gerrard's played 180 minutes for England. He's put in last night anyway, it was an old-fashioned barnstorming Gerrard performance. So it's interesting to see what kind of fitness levels he's going to have for Saturday. Obviously, he starts regardless. I don't think there's any question about that at all. But I do think that it will be a case of the game being won in an hour, and maybe we actually see Rodgers make the safe choice in taking Gerrard off to prevent the risk of injury. The big thing is we have one game a week now.
Yeah.
Whereas all the other competitors for top four spots, I think they have obviously Champions League, League Cup games coming up. We don't have any of that. It is okay. If we're beating Newcastle 2-3-4-0 by 60 minutes on Saturday, take Gerrard off. Give him that break.
Yeah.
But I want to see Alan get some kind of game time.
Do you think it's likely?
It's definitely likely, yeah. Because it's Joe Allen, I think it's likely. Okay. It depends on... Obviously, it all depends on how the game's going. You can't say he'll do this, he'll do that. I think, knowing Brendan, it will be for Lucas. I think Lucas starts on Saturday, which would be unfortunate for Henderson, because I think Henderson's going to get pushed out wide. Lucas will play, and then Alan comes in for one of either Gerrard or Lucas, depending on how the game's going.
Do you think Liverpool could be that comfortable in the game that they can afford to take Gerrard?
Well, 2-3 up with 60 minutes to go, do you think you can go that way with Liverpool?
Oh, yeah. Definitely. I think at this stage now, Liverpool are... The system had teething problems, but I think now at the back, we're good enough to go... After an hour, we're 3 up. You're not scoring. Simple as. With Sacco, Skrtel and Torre at the back.
That's delightfully optimistic. Yeah. I'm loving this so far. Loving the really confidence is. It's there, fantastic.
Have to say.
Can we move on to what we think about Newcastle's main threats? Because I know Phil's got some names that he wants to pronounce here. So could we? I'll start, Andy, with yourself. What are you thinking in terms of what we're likely to have to face with Newcastle in terms of threats and how we cope with them?
Yeah, okay. Remy for me, just I would be slightly concerned about Remy. Newcastle started off very slow. They have turned it around ever so slightly at home. And Remy has started to score a couple of goals. So it would be, if anyone would be worried about Remy, I think he is a quality player and I think he can do damage to us.
Okay.
Apart from that, I think Liverpool have enough to get a result there. We always seem to be able to get results at Newcastle. So let's just hope we get an early goal and shut their fans up.
Yeah, that's both of you in a row now, speaking about the early goal. You both think that's pretty important, obviously.
I think with an early goal at Liverpool constantly all last season seems and this season so far, just for the team, just to kind of loosen up and have a bit of belief, because how often we've seen Liverpool play well early on and then it doesn't happen for them. They almost get bored playing well.
Have we moved beyond that fragile confidence that we need an early goal?
Yes.
I hope so, but yeah. I don't think so. I definitely think the team we spoke about the lack of leadership and the lack of winners last season an awful lot, but I think they just need to just keep getting them early goals and just to have to get belief going into the second half, especially as we know performances dip in the second half. So now I do think the early goal is still very important.
That's vital. Steve Daly, your ideas.
Yeah, I think, as Andy said, Remy is going to be a threat. I think if Ben Arfa is fit and Caballé as well, they're going to be like Caballé. His set pieces are just exceptional.
Sure.
And we seem to be giving away a reasonable amount of stupid free kicks around in and around danger areas.
Yeah.
And his delivery is top notch, you know, and if we can cut that out and
it's our weak point, isn't it, defending?
Yeah, it is. Defending them, we're poor. And they're silly free kicks. They're for nothing. They're reasons that never need to be, you know, a free kick in the first place. You know, you see Sterling, you know, often coming in, taking a fella down for no reason whatsoever, 30-35 yards out.
Lucas is guilty of that.
Yeah, Lucas does it as well, absolutely. And I think that's where Caballé could hurt us.
That's an epidemic in the Premiership. It's not just Liverpool.
Absolutely.
No side seems to be able to defend set pieces at all lately.
The problem for me is that Caballé has the ability to smash it in the top corner.
Oh, but every side has one player that has that ability.
Yeah.
Liverpool have Suarez and Gerrard. But it just seems to be an epidemic within the Premiership that teams can't defend corners, can't defend balls whipped into the front post.
Yeah.
We've seen it numerous times with various different teams. They just can't defend them lately.
Is Ben Arfa fit this weekend, do we know? Or has anybody heard he is?
Yeah, so he is.
I'll go through the Newcastle team in a second.
here we go. Right.
Thanks, Alan Pardew. But I think he could be a big threat.
I think Ben Arfa's a super footballer.
Yeah, he's a smashing player and I think he's someone that's gonna cause us problems. Mm.
What about these little Ben Arfa to Liverpool shouts? Does that not fill you full of anxiety when you hear that?
No, not
you
at all.
You actually would like that?
Well, it depends on the money being quoted. I've seen stuff up to 20 million being quoted for us buying him. Absolutely not. Not with, you know, he's signed for Newcastle as a fella who struggled with injury and has struggled with injury at Newcastle. So for me, if you were bringing him in as an 8, 10, 12 million pound player, yeah, probably I think he's worth a shot. And he's not going to be our, you know, put it this way, would I swap him for Moses? Absolutely. Tomorrow, if I had the chance.
Would have swapped him for Coutinho?
No, absolutely
not.
But
I think that's the role Ben Arfa wants to play, is through the middle as a number 10. Yeah. And I wouldn't have him ahead of Coutinho.
No.
Also, I wouldn't do business with them gangsters either.
Here we go. That's another edit for you. it's brilliant. Phil, your thoughts on the Newcastle strengths, if you would, please. Just get yourself together, Chief.
Okay. Newcastle team. I'm reckoning it'll be Debussy.
Cruel and goal, is it?
Cruel and goal, yeah. Unless Fraser Foster comes back. Oh, he was signed to side. I go Debussy, Yanga and Biwa.
Sorry?
Yanga and Biwa, Taylor, and
Is he related to Justin Bieber?
Santon. Santon is the back four.
Actually has a crystal ball here, just by the way. Just
no, no, no. I did a bit of research and was talking to a few of my Toon supporting mates, and they were reckoning that's the back four.
Okay.
Although the one preface that says they think Williamson may start over Yanga and Biwa after his nightmare against us last year in the 6-0. He was a baptism of fire from midfield. It's going to be Tiote and Kaboy. And I'd imagine they'll have Sissoko as well. And by Jesus, Sissoko is the type of midfielder air midfield cannot deal with. And there's a few midfields in
he runs beyond them.
No, it's not just that. There's a few midfields in the Premiership which I worry about our current midfield coming up against.
West Ham.
Don't care. Well, no.
Southampton
is one. Yeah.
We're at the game.
Southampton has won. They had Wanyama and they have Schneiderlin in there. This one is another one. If Teote manages to find some form that he hasn't had in the last couple of years.
Yeah. What's happened with Teote? Because the first season he was absolutely brilliant.
I think, nobody knows, but it could be well that he thought he was going to get a big move. Didn't happen. And, you know, sometimes form can tail off. Yeah. But I'm just looking. Kaboy, Teote, and Sissoko. And Sissoko, with his power, that he can play that sort of attacking midfield role. Everyone was assuming that he was going to be signed as a defensive midfield role. He could power past Gerrard and Lucas, as we've seen Wanyama do for Southampton. As I'd imagine, we're probably going to see Jakub and Malumbu at West Brom do. And it's just a certain type of midfields that in the Premiership that I really feared the Lucas and Gerrard partnership, if that's what starts there on Saturday.
I think that's why Hendo has to come in.
Absolutely, Stephen, and that's why I need, if Hendo starts and even Lucas is on the bench, I'd be a lot more confident that midfield trio that Newcastle have won't boss us. Up top then, it's going to be Remy, Cisse, and it's a toss up. It's going to be Gouffran or Ben Arfa, and I'd imagine it'll probably fall on the side of Ben Arfa. Because although Gouffran's been playing well for them, and this is what the two lads were saying, but they didn't think Cisse would start unless he scored for Senegal because his form has been so bad recently for them. But he did score for Senegal, and again,
did Colo play
for
Ivory Coast?
I'm not sure. I didn't see anyway.
It was his first. Yeah, it was Colo since he was destroyed.
That Newcastle team, in reality, given the form they've had, shouldn't, in my opinion, be good enough to beat us if we're on form. The problem I have is that we're going in still not as a form team. We've won well in terms of putting points on the board, but we haven't won in terms of the style and verve and panache that we played with in the second half of last season.
We haven't put.
I know.
We say we don't care, but what I'm saying to you is, you get into a battle in St James's Park, and everyone keeps saying we have to get the early goal. We have to get the early goal. Well, actually, I'd be happy enough with a 1-0 or a 2-0 where we win with a goal in the last 20 minutes, because then the team has learned to do something different that it hasn't done this season. And I want to see this team progressing in every match it plays. And I would like, I don't, like, obviously I'd love to see a score in the first minute and again the second minute and put up a massive scoreline before we get to half time. But I'd be just as happy if we can win 1-0 or 2-0 with late goals as opposed to hitting the early goals, because the team will have learned how to win a match in the embers. And that to me is when teams make the jump from being a Europa League challenging side to being back in the running for a Champions League side.
Do you not think they showed that against Sunderland the second half, when Sunderland scored to go 2-1 and Sunderland came back?
That game was dead and buried at half time, and the fact the game was dead and buried in terms of their dominance in the hole. We let them back in. What I want to see is not a game that isn't dead and buried, where when they come out in the second half they can't afford to have that mental drop off.
The challenge,
yeah, that they actually have to go. We go back to the Southampton game. We came out there at nil all and we didn't show the power and strength and something different to go and raise our game again. I want to see us raise our game.
I get you.
All right, well, quickly, we start with yourself then, stay where you are, and tell us what you think in terms of prediction.
So it's going to be 4-0 to Newcastle.
Brilliant. Thanks for that. That makes lots of sense. Steve Brown, your idea as a prediction, what do you think?
I think 3-0 Liverpool. Early goal shuts up the James's Park crowd. They'll get on Newcastle back and make it easier for us. I think Sturridge scores, and yeah, we just run away with the game. I just see total. I don't know why But for some reason, I've turned the corner and I'm completely optimistic.
Yeah.
Right. Hey! I don't know what's going on. Like,
but no, I really do.
It's the new studio.
Yes, it's the studio.
He's the new studio.
It's because there's a big sunshine.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be Sturridge will score again. And
would you say, Stevo, that the level of optimism you're feeling at the moment is about 72? On the scale of optimism?
Maybe higher.
76?
I'd go 78.
Jesus, man, that's the highest we've been in a long
time. Imagine. Prediction, Steve O'Daly.
I'm about to bring the optimism down to about 46. I think it's an average game. We're working on a mean. I think it's a tighter game than that up there. Normally, we smash them, you know what I mean, or more times than not. But I think something about it is just telling me that we're going to labour through this one. And I hope I'm proved wrong. I hope I'm here next week saying, geez, I got that one miles off. But sure. I think 2-1 Liverpool.
I'm coming in behind you straight away on that. I think something similar. I think it could be very, very tight. And I'd worry, to be honest with you, that we'll come out on top. I think we probably have enough to do it. Andy, your ideas?
Yeah, I mean, probably last season that game was one of the most enjoyable matches for Liverpool, but we had Coutinho and he absolutely stole the show that day. He was absolutely brilliant. Unfortunately, we don't have him for this game, so it's going to be a lot tighter. It's not going to be as easy. I don't think it's going to be as easy as Stephen Brown was saying. I still think we win though. So the early goal, 1-0 at half time, and I think win the game 2-1, 3-1. I'd be very happy with that.
Very good.
And 78? I think it's 78. I think optimism. Yeah. After listening to Stephen Brown, 78, yeah.
A solid 78.
Solid 78.
We are going to win the league.
Obviously.
Now, if we're at winning the league stage, that's in the 80s.
That just broke the dial. Let's move on to the next one. Right, okay, listeners' questions is our last little part for today's pod. Our feature question comes from Neil Poole on Twitter. He says, should Sissoko start on Saturday? And I'm going to throw that around to everybody. So I'll start myself. And if Sissoko is fit to play, Sissoko should play, despite the fact that Phil loves a mentalist. I want Sissoko to play because we haven't seen him. And I think him and eventually Johnson will make a wonderful pairing. So that's my shout. I'm going to go back to Stephen Brown.
I think definitely Sissoko should play. I think there is a possibility this lad is as batshit mental as Enrique.
Possibly, yeah.
I think he is just going all... From the few minutes that we've seen of him against Villa, where it was just head down and he charges through players. He's like, he looks similar to a more athletic version of Sacco.
Okay.
And that's only a good thing.
Brilliant. Andy?
No, I don't think so.
you don't think he should?
No, I don't think he should. He's only coming back from injury. Just leave Enrique in there. Look, I'm not Enrique's biggest fan, but... I think he has a performance in there, back up at James Park. With the three centre backs, he's a little bit more protected. And yeah, I think leave Enrique in.
Leave Enrique.
Do you remember when he went in goal there 2 years ago?
Yeah, that's always a sign of a mentalist. Phil, speaking of goalkeepers and mentalists, your idea of whether he should or should not start if he's fit?
Well, I named him in my starting 11, so that answers the question.
No, that's what you'd like. Do you think he should? Yeah, you do.
Oh yeah. I think it's always good as well for competition and the whole lot that there is rotation through a team. Yeah. And Enrique, for as much as I love his madness, he has struggled in recent games. Now, he hasn't been poor, but he hasn't been great. And I would love to see, with Johnson missing from this side, an attacking threat from one of the the wing back positions, but who's also as solid defensively because they played in that position for most of their career.
That's a definite yes. And Steve Daly, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm actually a bit surprised at how much backing he's getting here to start, because, you know, it's not Coutinho coming back into the side, it's not Suarez coming back into the side. We've hardly seen him. He's you know, he's coming to us on the back of 18 months, 2 years of not being that great, to
You're
be honest
battering
with you.
Optimism here.
Yeah. Well, I'm just being honest about it, you know, so I don't know if throwing him into St. James's Park is the place to do it. I think maybe a handier game at home. Okay. And you know what I mean, especially if I don't think we will, but if we were to revert to a 4-4-2, I definitely wouldn't be putting him in.
But can, just on that, right, given that Enrique was at Newcastle, would the element of surprise of launching Sissoko in there not be a good thing to have, because they know the ins and outs of Enrique's game?
Only if he plays well.
Yeah, they know to leave him with the ball and just point him
at
towards the corner flag.
At some stage, he's going to give it back.
Yeah, but he's also some man to pick out Suarez as well. Yeah, we've seen the balls that he puts in. And
listen, I can see the logic in playing Enrique.
Yeah, but for me, I'd be putting Enrique in there. And you know what? If we're doing well, we're 2-3 nil up.
60 minutes. Let's swap Enrique out for Sissoko there, and give him a run. Get 30 minutes.
It's a hell of a lot more likely. Yeah.
Okay, I'm just gonna go around everyone a few quick fire questions. So literally keep these answers short if you would. Middle bit over and back perhaps. The first one. Now, Steve, I saw you chatting to this man on Twitter earlier on, so we'll leave you out of this one. Andy, I'm going to come to you for this. Neb, at Neb and Ead on Twitter, asks, at what point do we just let go and enjoy being top?
Well, I let go at 2 o'clock on the first day of the season when Liverpool went top of the league, and I enjoyed it then.
And he's still there.
And I post the table every week on Facebook. So I'm loving it, and I don't give a shit what anyone else thinks.
You're not afraid to revel. You don't have any superstitious crap about, you know, not taking it for granted. You're just happy to enjoy it.
Oh, delighted while it lasts. Yeah, absolutely. And if we're there at Christmas, even better. If we're there in January, brilliant. But I enjoyed it the first day of the season, I have to say. It looked fairly nice.
Perfect. Nice to see. Next question, Phil, I'll go to you. This one's from Colin Turley.
Do I not get a chance to answer them?
No, you don't. No.
Why not?
Because I'm not letting you. This is at Colin Turley. He says, if LFC didn't exist, Phil, which footy club do you think you'd have fallen for? And he's not letting you pick Celtic.
I wouldn't pick Celtic anyway.
That's
sound.
It's all a Celtic following,
guys. You can say you like Celtic.
I won't have my views.
Well, if Liverpool doesn't exist, does English league football exist? Because I wouldn't be picking any team there anyway, so I'd be going with Ajax.
Okay.
I had the first non-Liverpool jersey I had was an Ajax jersey in about 87, 88. It was mad. It was this blue thing. It was their away jersey as well, and it had a little button, but it had sort of this weird Croatian Czech pattern running through it, and it wasn't the traditional Ajax jersey. It was just steady. It was maybe Umbro. So yeah.
So Ajax based in the jersey, very good. Listen, seeing as you got all bent out of shape, why don't you just have a quick response to Neb's question about when do we let go? Have you let go? Are you enjoying it? Liverpool being top of the league.
Who wouldn't enjoy it? But I can't let go. Not until we get to May and we're in the top four.
Okay.
Yeah, I would agree there. I find it very, very hard to...
The prize is too big. I'm not talking about winning the league, right? The prize of the Champions League in terms of where we can go as a club is too big to let go, not wanting us to stay there, right? And the real challenges come over the next 8 weeks.
Well, can I say, knowing the chap, I think what Neb's reacting to there is the incredible level of moaniness amongst Liverpool supporters. I mean, we win.
Football fans moan.
I think it's
a fear.
That's
what football fans do.
As I replied to Neb today, I think it's a fear.
Yeah. It is a fear.
Of what we know, it could turn out like.
Because of what we've had since
Benitez left.
Yeah. Yeah. We can still, in the back of our mind, see us sitting in 8th.
Optimism. And today's optimism level is?
Well,
Steelers just called
78.
78.
78.
Yeah. We came out of the international.
We're one of the hardest teams to support in the world. It's just unbelievable sometimes.
Yeah.
It's a chore. Next one up.
Not a chore.
Is for you.
You can call
Steve
it a chore
Daly.
If you want.
I didn't. I'm just speaking for the general population. Will you try to stop trying to stitch me up on it? Swear to God, I will come at you. Next one is from Jag. That's at Jag Desh on Twitter again. And Steve Daly is for yourself. He asked, what do you make of Joe Allen's decline in form, and do you think he can get back to being what they used to call the Welsh Xavi?
Well, I don't know what mentalists call him. It was probably fellas like Phil that called him the Welsh Xavi, other crazy people. I think he can get back to a good, steady level and be a good player for us. I never saw the hype. If I'm honest, when we signed him from Swansea, I didn't see him as the answer to what he was being sold as. I didn't see the price tag being justified at what we paid for him, if I'm honest, either. And fair enough, I probably was eating humble pie for the first 5 or 6 games last season. But the decline was, he's probably gone back to where I thought he would be when we signed him. I saw him as a failure, if I'm honest. I really do hope he can come in and add a little bit of... creativity and you know, like I said, we were talking about last week, him and Hendo, I would actually like to see when he's back to full fitness and has match fitness under his belt, because it would be great to see two lads that can properly retain possession.
Steve, do you think those first couple of games where he looked frankly imperious, do you think that was an anomaly?
I think he was on the crest of a wave, and I think ultimately, as we faltered a little bit, it started to affect him. I think maybe he felt the pressure. There is the whole thing about him having a kid and all that, but I don't buy into that nowadays. You know what I mean? We're talking about, we were talking last week about sayings that are 35, they're 35 years old. And the problem is, back then, the money wasn't in football that's there now. You didn't have nannies, you didn't have whatever else. So I don't buy into that.
Okay.
I think unfortunately, the guy's gone backwards. Hopefully he can dig himself out of a hole and be a productive player for us this season.
Okay.
Can just on it.
Please.
I think he can get back to being the Welsh Javi.
You do?
Yeah.
Did you think he was the Welsh Javi in the first place?
Yeah.
Okay.
Jesus Christ, I'd love to know what Javi thought about him.
No, like it's like Martin Maldini.
Jesus, we're not going there. This way,
he was looking for a segue there.
Martin Maldini.
Every episode we have to have Martin Maldini. No, in all seriousness. I think if we put Alan in the position that he was signed for and play him in the position he was signed for, then we will see the player that Swansea had that we paid the money for. Until we put Joe Allen into that position,
I completely agree.
Yeah. We're not going
that
to
only
that
works
player.
That only works for Liverpool with Gerrard as a 10. Doesn't work beside Gerrard.
Okay. We'll try another one then. This is from Graham Casson. That's at GJC78 on Twitter, and he asks, is the academy really all that? In fact, he asks, who was the last quality product that we sold for a meaningful profit? Andy, or Steve Brown, sorry, thoughts on that?
Yeah, the academy is and it isn't. It's very hard to hold up players that have come through the academy. There's a vast number of players that have come through Liverpool's academy that haven't made the first team or have made 10, 20, 30 appearances as substitutes. I've moved on to better, not better things obviously, but I've moved on to decent things elsewhere.
Been respectable.
Yeah. There's people who say that there needs to be a stepping stone. There can't be under 21 reserve team football to the Premiership. There's such a drop off from Premiership to that. When you look at Spain and you look at the likes of Barca B and Real Madrid B and so on, they're playing competitive league football. Obviously it's a lower level than the first team, but they still have 36, 38 competitive games a season.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't be signing Luis Alberto for 7 million quid or 6 million quid from Barca B if he hadn't played no competitive football. We wouldn't be signing him for that much money out of Barcelona's under 21 side. So I think the academy could be that if there's that stepping stone was brought in, which obviously has to come down to the Premier League or the FA.
Yeah. There's a can of worms there with Luis Alberto's name on it that we'll have to come back to at a different time. I think we'll start to wrap it up, Chance, if we're okay with that. There was one particular thing as well that came in from At Gray Not David. He's a regular friend of the pod, and he asked me to pass on to you chaps, would you please turn off your phones? he wasn't happy with the last pod.
But we have.
Sorry, Gray. Sorry, Gray, not David. It's a bit late now, trying to at the end of the pod.
I wasn't
don't
there,
record
sorry.
This bit at the start. Fair play, Trev.
Sorry.
Excellent shit that is, man. Fucking professional we are. When you're talking to the microphone as well.
Okay, listen, we're going to wrap it up here, chaps. Your day trippers tonight were Steve Daly, Phil Casey, Stephen Brown, Andy Young and myself, Trevor Downey. This is the Day Trippers. We'll see you next week.